May and Ada and I stayed out of it, us still being adequate vessels for a good licking, the last we'd heard. Even though someone could have pointed out to Father that at least somebody finally brought home some bacon at our house. Someone could have remarked that it is Leah who wears the pants in our family, which is true. Mother took sides against Father without saying so, in the noisy way she stacked the plates. Then suddenly, from one second to the next, they were all transposed on Nelson, who came running into the house afraid for his life. It was something about a snake. He'd seen the evil sign outside our chicken house. Well, that was hardly a surprise, because for the last few days, people had been finding snakes every place. Inside the house, for instance, inside a bean basket with the lid on tight, places where you wouldn't think it was natural for a snake to be. Everybody was so afraid, Nelson said, you could see afraid walking around on its own 2 feet. When he saw the evil sign, it sent him singing like a canary, because our chicken house is where he sleeps. He was positive he was doomed, and there was just no reasoning with him. Mother did try, but he wouldn't listen. He said he'd been just fixing to go to bed when he heard a sound and went outside to look. When he stepped out the door, 2 shadows in the shape of an X fell across his path. Lately, he's been tying the chicken house door shut with a rope when he turns in for the night, but now it was plain to see no rope was going to be strong enough. Nelson was not going to sleep in our chicken house for all the teeth in China. Well, any 2 straight things can make a shadow of an X, is what Mother told him, which is true, especially with a wild imagination coming into play. Probably some clown is just trying to scare him and needs a good poke in the puss. But Nelson said this was not just ordinary shadows. He said it was the dreaming of snakes. Father announced this was the unfortunate effect of believing in false idols, and he washed his hands of the affair. He was washing his hands left and right that evening. Mother didn't necessarily agree with him, but I could see she didn't want us going anywhere near that chicken house to investigate. Father quoted a Bible verse about the only thing we had to fear was fear itself. He told Mother if she let Nelson sleep in our house that night, she'd be playing directly into the hands of the idol worshippers, and if she wanted to count herself as one of them, she could take her children and go seek shelter among them. Then he turned to us and declared it was high time for us to go to bed and put the light out on laughable Congolese superstitions. But Nelson slunk out of the house in such a terrified state we couldn't find anything to laugh about, that's for sure. Even Anatole had been telling us to be extra careful right now, and Anatole, I must admit, has his head firmly attached to his shoulders. We tried to get ready for bed, but all we could hear was Nelson outside whimpering to be allowed to come in, and we became scared out of our minds. Even Leah did. We did not believe in voodoo spirits and informed each other of that fact till we were blue in the face. But still, there was some dark thing out there watching us from the forest and coiling up under people's beds at night. And whether you call it fear or the dreaming of snakes or false idolatry or what, it's still something. It doesn't care what prayers we say at bedtime or whether we admit we believe in it. Does it believe in us? That's the question. We lay in our beds listening to Nelson's steady, high-pitched begging. Sticky-toed lizards ran sideways along the walls. The moon made shadows on our mosquito netting. Nelson pleaded, "Bakala Umputu, Nelson, Bakala Umputu," over and over like a poor starving dog that's been whining so long it doesn't know how to stop. We heard Father's bed springs groan suddenly, then Father at the window yelling for him to shut up. Leah rolled over and put her pillow on her head. I felt sick to my stomach. We all did. Father's hatefulness and Mother's silent fright were infecting our minds. "This is wrong," Leah said finally. "I'm going to help him. Who has the guts to come with me?" The thought of going out there gave me the willies, but if the others went, I wasn't going to stay in here with the shadows and lizards either. I think our house gave me the willies worst of all. That house was the whole problem because it had our family in it. I was long past the point of feeling safe huddling under my parents' wings. Maybe when we first came to the Congo, I did, because we were all just hardly more than children then, but now everything has changed. Being American doesn't matter, and nobody gives us any special credit. Now we're all in this stew pot together, black or white, regardless. And certainly we're not children. Leah says in Congo there's only 2 ages of people, babies that have to be carried and people that stand up and fend for themselves. No in-between phase. No such thing as childhood. Sometimes I think she's right. After a while, she said again, "I'm going out there to help Nelson, and Father can go straight to hell." Whether we said so or not, the rest of us certainly agreed upon where Father could go straight to. Surprisingly, Ada sat up and started to pull on her jeans. That was her way of saying, "I'm in." So I felt around on the floor for my penny loafers. Leah pulled Ruth May's shirt on over her head and stuck her tennis shoes on her feet. As quiet as mice, we crept outside through the window. What we decided to do was set a trap like Daniel in the temple. This was Leah's inspiration. Nelson raked a pan of cold ashes out of the stove, and together we strewed them all around the hard pan dirt yard outside the chicken house. Inside it, too. We worked by candlelight. Nelson kept a lookout to make sure no one saw us. But Ruth May was careless, and the rest of us were also to some extent, and made tracks over each other's tracks. Then our two chickens got disturbed by our light, since they'd come from a different way of life over at Mama Mwanza's and weren't used to living in our chicken house yet, so they ran around making chicken tracks on top of everything. We had to sweep it all up and start over. The second time, we were much more careful. We made Ruth May stand in one spot and chase the chickens back into the nest box to roost. They looked down at us with their stupid little eyes and made soft noises into their feathers to calm themselves down. When it was all done, we made Nelson promise to hide out the night at Anatole's and come back before daybreak. Leah ran halfway there with him because he was scared and came back by herself. We all tiptoed inside to our beds, leaving the ashes perfect behind us like newly fallen snow. If anyone or anything set foot in our chicken house, if it had feet, that is, we would catch the culprit red-handed. Ada. There are 7 ways for a foot to touch the ground, each with its own particular power. Did he know how it would come to us in the end? Should I have known? For I had watched him long before, watched him dancing foot to ground, watched him throw the bones. In the clearing behind our house is where he made his trouble. With his machete, he cut off the heads of 2 small living dogs and pressed their noses to the ground, reciting promises. Against him, quietly, I unlocked my voice and sang in the forest. I sang against him my most perfect backward-forward hymns, because I have no other powers of my own. Live to tune, rare nut, a devil. Live to devil, live to devil. Wet stab noses on bad stew. Evil deed live, evil deed live. Sun opus rat, sea stars upon us. I level eye, worn rotten Ada, net torn raw. I did peep, did I? On the morning after we spread the ashes, we woke before sunrise. Wondering what we might have caught in our trap, we lay still and wide-eyed in our beds until Nelson's face appeared at our open window. Then, while our parents still slept, we tiptoed out of the house. Nelson, with a pole twice as tall as himself, waited for us. In the company of nothing but our fear itself, we went to the chicken house. Strange to say, if you do not stamp yourself with the words exhilarated or terrified, those 2 things feel exactly the same in a body. Creeping past our parents' bedroom and out the door, our bodies felt as they did on Christmas past and all the Easter mornings of the world when Christ is risen and our mother has hidden a tribe of sugared marshmallow bunnies in the startled grass of a parsonage lawn in Bethlehem, Georgia. Ruth May, marvel-eyed with a hand cupped over her mouth, I have willed myself to forget, 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 and not forget. For those eyes will see through everything, even my dreams. Ruth May, with the eyes of an Easter morning. As Nelson knew it would be, it was there inside the chicken house. He stopped us in the doorway, and we froze behind his outstretched arm until we saw it, too, in the far corner in the nest box, curled tightly around our 2 precious hens and all their eggs. 2 poor, ruffled-feathered mothers without a breath between them, bound to their stillborn future. Nest, eggs, and hens were all 1 package, wrapped in a vivid, slender twine of brilliant green. It was so pretty, so elaborately basket-woven among hen and egg, we did not at first understand what we saw. A tisket, a tasket, a gift. Nelson raised his long pole and shoved hard, hitting the wall above the nest so dust rained down on the dark, quiet hens. The green vine shifted suddenly, every part at once moving up, down, or sideways. Stopped, then moved forward 1 more inch through the path of its knot. A small blunt head emerged and swiveled to face us. Very slowly, it split itself wide, showing the bright blue inside of its mouth. 2 bare fangs. A tongue, delicately licking the air. Suddenly, it flew at the pole, striking twice, then flung itself from the nest box and shot past us out the door into the bright morning. Gone. Without breathing, we stared at the place where the snake had been, until our eyes caught up and we could all witness our memory of what had passed before us. Green Mamba, Mistress of Camouflage, Agility, Aggressiveness, and Speed. La Géniosité Diabolique de la Nature, A Atien avec, Ce Serpent, Le Plus Haut Degré de Perfection, the experts claim in the library books of snakes. In this serpent, the diabolic genius of nature has attained the highest degree of perfection. What had passed before us was a basket of death exploded, a gift meant for Nelson. Three of us then breathed together, dropped our eyes to the white ash floor. A foot had marked that floor in all the seven ways of a dance. Footprints fanned out in tight circles. Evil deed, live. Not the paws of a leopard walking upright, turned against men by irreverence. Not the belly slither of angry snakes coming up from the sheltered ground of their own accord to punish us. Only a man, one man and no other, who brought the snake in a basket or carried it stunned or charmed like a gift in his own two hands. Only one single dancer, with six toes on his left foot. Leah. I only remember hearing a gulp and a sob and a scream all at once, the strangest cry, like a baby taking its first breath. We couldn't tell where it came from, but strangely enough, we all looked up at the treetops. A nervous wind stirred the branches, but nothing more. Only silence fell down. It's a very odd thing to recall that we all looked up. Not one of us looked at Ruth May. I can't say that Ruth May was even there with us in that instant. Just for the moment, it was as if she'd disappeared and her voice was thrown into the trees. Then she returned to us, but all that was left of her was an awful silence. The voiceless, empty skin of my baby sister sitting quietly on the ground, hugging herself. "Ruth May, honey, it's all right," I said. "The bad snake is gone." I knelt down beside her, gently taking hold of her shoulder. "Don't be scared. It's gone." Nelson knelt, too, putting his face close to hers. He opened his mouth to speak, to reassure her, I imagine, for he loved Ruth May. I know this. I've seen how he sings to her and protects her. But the terrible silence took hold of Nelson, too, and no words came. His eyes grew wide as we all watched her face change to a pale blue mask pulled down from her hairline to her swollen lips. No eyes. What I mean is that no one we recognized was looking out through her eyes. "Ruth May, what is it? What? What did you see?" In my panic, I shook her hard, and I think I must have screamed those words at her. I can't change what I did. I shook her too hard and screamed at her. Maybe that was the last she knew of her sister, Leah. Nelson shoved me away. He'd come to life again suddenly and spoke so fast in Kikongo I couldn't think how to understand. He tore her blouse open, just ripped it, and put his face against her chest, then drew back in horror. As we watched in dismay, I remember thinking I should pay attention to where the buttons fell so I could help her sew them back on later. Buttons are so precious here. The strangest things I thought of, so ridiculous, because I couldn't look at what was in front of me. "Miniki!" he screamed at me. I waited for the word to pierce my dumb, thick brain and begin to mean something. "Milk!" he was shouting. "Get milk! Of a goat, a dog, any kind, to draw out the poison. Get Mama Nguza," he said. "She will know what to do. She saved her son from a green mamba once. Kaka, kaka, go!" But I found I couldn't move. I felt hot and breathless and stung like an antelope struck with an arrow. I could only stare at Ruth May's bare left shoulder where two red puncture wounds stood out like red beads on her flesh, two dots an inch apart, as small and tidy as punctuation marks at the end of a sentence none of us could read. The sentence would have started somewhere just above her heart. Ada. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. I was not present at Ruth May's birth, but I have seen it now, because I saw each step of it played out in reverse at the end of her life. The closing parenthesis at the end of the palindrome that was Ruth May. Her final gulp of air as hungry as a baby's first breath. That last howling scream exactly like the first, and then at the end a fixed, steadfast moving backward out of this world. After the howl, wide-eyed silence without breath. Her bluish face creased with a pressure closing in, the near proximity of the other-than-life that crowds down around the edges of living. Her eyes closed up tightly and her swollen lips clamped shut. Her spine curved, and her limbs drew in more and more tightly until she seemed impossibly small. While we watched without comprehension, she moved away to where none of us wanted to follow. Ruth May shrank back through the narrow passage between this brief fabric of light and all the rest of what there is for us, the long waiting. Now she will wait the rest of the time. It will be exactly as long as the time that passed before she was born. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me, or paused, at least, to strike a glancing blow with his sky-blue mouth as he passed. A lightning that cannot strike twice, our lesson learned in the hateful speed of light. A bite at light, at Ruth, a truth, a sky-blue presentiment, and oh, how dear we are to ourselves when it comes. It comes, that long, long shadow in the grass. Rachel. There's a strange moment in time after something horrible happens, when you know it's true, but you haven't told anyone yet. Of all things, that is what I remember most. It was so quiet, and I thought, now we have to go in and tell Mother that Ruth May is, oh, sweet Jesus, Ruth May is gone. We had to tell our parents, and they were still in bed asleep. I didn't cry at first, and then, I don't know why, but I fell apart when I thought of Mother in bed sleeping. Mother's dark hair would be all askew on the pillow and her face sweet and quiet, her whole body just not knowing yet. Her body that had carried and given birth to Ruth May last of all, Mother asleep in her nightgown, still believing she had four living daughters. Now we were going to put one foot in front of the other, walk to the back door, go in the house, stand beside our parents' bed, wake up Mother, say to her the words, Ruth May. Say the word, dead. Tell her, Mother, wake up. The whole world would change then, and nothing would ever be all right again, not for our family. All the other people in the whole wide world might go on about their business, but for us it would never be normal again. I couldn't move. None of us could. We looked at each other because we knew someone should go, but I think we all had the same strange idea that if we stood there without moving forever and ever, we could keep our family the way it was. We would not wake up from this nightmare to find out it was someone's real life, and for once, that someone wasn't just a poor, unlucky nobody in a shack you could forget about. It was our life, the only one we were going to have, the only Ruth May. Until that moment, I'd always believed I could still go home and pretend the Congo never happened. The misery, the hunt, the ants, the embarrassments of all we saw and endured, those were just stories I would tell someday with a laugh and a toss of my hair when Africa was far away and make-believe like the people in history books. The tragedies that happened to Africans were not mine. We were different, not just because we were white and had our vaccinations, but because we were simply a much, much luckier kind of person. I would get back home to Bethlehem, Georgia, and be exactly the same Rachel as before. I'd grow up to be a carefree American wife with nice things and a sensible way of life and three grown sisters to share my ideals and talk to on the phone from time to time. This is what I believed. I'd never planned on being someone different. Never imagined I would be a girl they'd duck their eyes from and whisper about as tragic for having suffered such a loss. I think Leah and Ada also believed these things in their own different ways, and that is why none of us moved. We thought we could freeze time for just one more minute, and one more after that, that if none of us confessed it, we could hold back the curse that was going to be our history. Leah. Mother did not rant or tear her hair. She behaved as if someone else had already told her before we got there. Silently, she dressed, tied back her hair, and set herself to a succession of chores, beginning with tearing down the mosquito netting from all of our beds. We were afraid to ask what she was doing. We didn't know whether she wanted us all to get malaria now for punishment or if she had simply lost her mind. So we stood out of her way and watched, all of us, even Father. For once, he had no words to instruct our minds and improve our souls, no parable that would turn Ruth May's death by snakebite into a lesson on the glory of God. My father, whose strong hands always seized whatever came along and molded it to his will, seemed unable to grasp what had happened. She wasn't baptized yet, he said. I looked up when he said this, startled by such a pathetically inadequate observation. Was that really what mattered to him right now, the condition of Ruth May's soul? Mother ignored him, but I studied his face in the bright morning light. His blue eyes, with their left-sided squint, weakened by the war, had a vacant look. His large reddish ears repelled me. My father was a simple, ugly man. It's true that she wasn't baptized. If any one of us had cared about that, we could lay the blame on Father. He'd maintained that Ruth May was still too young to take the responsibility of accepting Christ, but in truth, I think he was holding her back for the sake of pageantry. He was going to baptize his own child, along with all of Kalanga's, on that great day down at the river when his dream finally came true. It would lend an appearance of sincerity to the occasion. Now he seemed narrow-witted and without particular dreams. I couldn't stand to look at him standing in the doorway, his body hanging from its frame with nothing but its own useless hands for company, and all he could think to say to his wife was, "This can't be." It couldn't be, but it was, and Mother alone among us seemed to realize that. With a dark scarf over her hair and the sleeves of her stained white blouse rolled up, she did her work as deliberately as the sun or moon, a heavenly body tracking its course through our house. Her tasks moved her continually away from us, her senseless shadows, a husband and living daughters. With determined efficiency, she gathered up everything she would need from one room before she moved to the next, in the way I remember her doing when we were all much younger and needed her more. She went out to the kitchen house, fired the stove, warmed a pan of water, then carried it back into the house and set it on the big dining table where Nelson had laid the body on a bedsheet. Mother bathed Ruth May with a washcloth as if she were a baby. I stood with my back to the wall, remembering too much of another time, as I watched her rub carefully under the chin and in the folds at the backs of the elbows and knees. In our house in Bethlehem, I used to stand outside the bathroom door where I could see the two of them in the mirror, Mother singing soft questions and kissing her answers into the tiny outstretched palms. Ada and I were 9 then, too old to be jealous of a baby, but still I had to wonder if she had ever loved me that much. With twins, she could only have loved each of us by half, and Ada was the one who required more of her. A honey creeper sang from the bushes outside the window. It seemed impossible that an ordinary bright day should be proceeding outside our house. Mother spread a small, soft hand onto hers and washed the fingers one at a time. She cradled and lifted the head to rinse it, taking care not to get the soapy water in Ruth May's eyes. As she dried the limp, blonde hair with a towel, she leaned in close, inhaling the scent of my sister's scalp. I felt invisible. By the force of my mother's desire to conduct this ritual in private, she had caused me to disappear. Still, I couldn't leave the room. After she dried and wrapped her baby in a towel, she hummed quietly while combing out the tangles and plaiting the damp hair. Then she began to cut our mosquito netting into long sheets and stitch the layers together. At last we understood. She was making a shroud. "Leah, help me move this table outside," she said when she was finished. It was the first time she'd spoken in more than half a day to anyone, and I jumped to do as I was told. She moved Ruth May to her own bed while we moved the big heavy table out into the center of the front yard. We had to turn it on end to get it out the door. When we set it down, the legs settled soundly into the dust so it did not wobble as it had always done inside the house. Mother went back inside and returned with the shrouded body in her arms. Gently, she laid Ruth May out on the table, spending a long time arranging her arms and legs within the sheer cloth. The shade of the mango stretched all the way across the yard, and I realized it must be afternoon, a fact that surprised me. I looked at several familiar things, one at a time, a striped green mango lying in the grass, my own hand, our dining table. All these things seemed like objects I hadn't seen before. I looked at the table and forced my mind to accept the words, "This is my dead sister." But Ruth May was shrouded in so many misty layers of mosquito netting I could barely make out any semblance of a dead child inside. She looked more like a billowy cloud that could rise right up through the trees whenever Mother finally let her go. Nelson was weaving together palm fronds to make a funeral arch of leaves and flowers to set over the table. It looked something like an altar. I thought perhaps I ought to help him, but I couldn't think how. Several women from the village had already come. Mama Mwanza arrived first with her daughters. A few at a time, the others followed. They fell down at the edge of our yard when they came and walked on their knees to the table. All of them had lost children before, it dawned on me through my shock. Our suffering now was no greater than theirs had been, no more real or tragic, no different. They all knelt around the table silently for quite a while, and I knew I should join them, but I felt unaccountably afraid to get close to the table. I stayed at the back of the group. Suddenly, one woman shrieked, and I felt my skull would split open. All the others immediately joined in with the quivering high Bilala. I felt blood rushing through all the narrow parts of my body, the wrists, the throat, the backs of my knees. Ada was white-faced beside me and looked into my eyes as if she were drowning. We'd heard this strange mourning song many times before, back during the heavy rains when so many children got sick. It had tricked us at first, more than once, sending us running to the windows to see what beautiful exotic birds made such a strange call. Now, of course, we couldn't think of birds. The trilling of our neighbor's tongue set loose knives that cut the flesh from our bones and made us fall down with our shame and our love and our anger. We were all cut down together by the knife of our own hope, for if there is any single thing that everyone hopes for most dearly, it must be this, that the youngest outlive the oldest. In our family, the last was first. I would like to believe she got what she wanted. I ground my knees in the dust and shook and sobbed and opened my mouth to cry aloud. I crossed my arms over my chest and held onto my own shoulders, thinking of Ruth May's sharp, skinny shoulder blades under her little white shirt, thinking of Aunt Lyons and Mother May I, recalling her strange, transfigured shadow the last time I pushed her in the swing. The sounds of our voices rose up through the tree branches into the sky, but Ruth May did not. When the wailing finally stopped, we were wrapped in silence and the buzzing of locusts. The air was thick and ponderous with humidity. It felt like a wet wool blanket you could not take off. Mother had begun moving all of our furniture into the yard, first the chairs, then our beds, and my father's roll-top desk. These heavy things she dragged by herself, even though I know for a fact that 2 months ago she couldn't have moved them. I continued to watch without any particular expectation as she emerged next with our clothes and books. Then our cooking pots. She stacked these things on the chairs and desk. The women watched closely, as my sisters and I did, but no one moved. Mother stood looking at us all, waiting. Finally, she took the good skillet we'd brought from home and pressed it into Mama Mwanza's hands. She offered our blouses and dresses to Mama Mwanza's children. They accepted them in both hands, thanked her, and left. Mama Mwanza balanced the skillet on her head since she needed her hands for walking and solemnly led her family away from our funeral. Tentatively, the other women touched our things. Their initial reluctance gave way to excited chatter as they began to sort through the piles of our possessions, unabashedly holding our clothes up to their children's chests, scrutinizing such oddities as a hairbrush and fingernail clippers, thumping on the enamel pans with their knuckles to test their worth. Eventually, they took what they needed and left. But the children soon came back, unable to resist the scene of such a spectacle. Just as they used to do when we first arrived here, they materialized one by one out of the moist air and the bamboo thickets until they'd formed a silent, watchful circle around the periphery of our yard. I suppose they were as astonished as we were that a member of our family was capable of death. Gradually they crept forward, closing their circle around the table, and there they remained for a very long time, staring at Ruth May. Mother had gone back in the house where we could hear her strange, tireless industry moving upon the empty rooms. Our father seemed to be nowhere. My sisters and I stayed outside with the children because they seemed to embrace our presence. Out of habit, we knelt on the ground and prayed the dumb prayers of our childhood, Our Father which art in heaven, and, Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. I could not remotely believe any shepherd was leading me through this dreadful valley, but the familiar words stuffed my mouth like cotton, and it was some relief to know, at least, that one sentence would follow upon another. It was my only way of knowing what to do. Whenever I stopped praying, the buzz of the locusts grew horrible in my ears, so I didn't stop. Sometimes Rachel prayed with me, and sometimes the Congolese children also prayed in whatever words they knew. I recited the 23rd Psalm, the 121st Psalm, the 100th and the 137th and the 19th and the 66th Psalms, the 21st chapter of Revelation, Genesis 1, Luke 22, 1 Corinthians, and finally John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Then I stopped. It was very late in the afternoon, and I could think of no more prayers. I'd come to the end of all I knew. I listened to the world around me, but all other sound had ceased entirely. Not a single bird called. I felt terrified. The air seemed charged and dangerous, but I couldn't pray anymore, and I couldn't get up and do anything else. To go back inside our empty house where Mother was, especially, I couldn't make myself do. Not for anything. It seemed impossible. So I stayed where I was, kneeling beside my sisters with our heads bowed low beneath the crackling air. The sky groaned and cracked, and suddenly the shrill, cold needles of rain pierced our hands and the backs of our necks. A thunderstorm broke open, and with a strength as mighty as the thirst of crops and animals, the rain poured down on our heads. It lashed us hard, answering months of prayers. Some of the smaller children rushed to break off elephant ear leaves for umbrellas, but most of us simply stayed where we were, receiving the downpour. Lightning sang and hissed around our shoulders, and the thunder bellowed. Our father came out of the house and stood looking at the sky, holding out his hands. It seemed to take him a long time to believe in the rain. "The Lord spoke to the common people gathered at the well," he said at last, in his old booming voice that allowed no corner for doubt. He had to shout to be heard above the noise of the downpour. "And the Lord told them, 'Whosoever drinks of this ordinary water will be thirsty again, but the water I will give unto him will quench his thirst forever. It will become a spring within him, bubbling up for eternal life.'" The children weren't paying much mind right then to my father or his bubbling spring of eternal life. They were so transfixed by the rain. They held up their faces and arms to the cold water as if the whole of their skin were a manioc field that needed to be soaked. "If anyone is thirsty," my father shouted, "let him come to me and drink. If anyone believes in me, streams of living water shall flow forth from his heart." He walked to a tall boy near me, Pascal's half-brother. I'd spoken to him twice and knew his name was Lucien, though I'm sure my father didn't know it. Nevertheless, Father held out his large white hand and spread his fingers wide over the boy's head. Lucien looked my father in the eye as if he expected to be struck, but he didn't flinch. "I am the voice of one shouting in the desert. Straighten the Lord's way," my father cried. "I am only baptizing in water, but someone is standing among you of whom you do not know. He is God's Lamb, who is to remove the world's sin." My father lowered his hand and closed his fingers gently over the top of Lucien's head. "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, I baptize you, my son. Walk forward into the light." Lucien didn't move. Father took his hand away and waited, I suppose, for the miracle of baptism to take hold. Then he turned to Lucien's tiny sister, Bwanga, who held onto Lucien's hand for dear life. Their mother had died during the disease time, and their father's other wife, Pascal's mother, had taken them both into her house. Throughout this time of loss and salvation, Bwanga had remained Ruth May's most loyal playmate. Even that my father wouldn't have known. I felt an unspeakable despair. He knew nothing about the children. Under his cupped hand, Bwanga's little bald head looked like an overripe avocado he was prepared to toss away. She stood wide-eyed and motionless. "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost," he repeated, and released her. "Mada, may I?" Bwanga asked. Several other children remembered this game and echoed, "Mada, may I?" Their eyes left Father and came to rest on Ruth May inside the drenched cloud of netting on the table. They all picked up the refrain, asking again and again in a rising plea, "Mother, may I?" And though they surely knew no permission would be granted, they kept up their soft, steady chant for a very long time in the pouring rain. Water clung to their eyelashes and streamed in runnels down their open faces. Their meager clothes, imposed on them by foreigners, clung to their thin chests and legs like a second skin, finally ready to accept the shape of their bodies. The dust on our feet turned blood-colored, and the sky grew very dark, while Father moved around the circle, baptizing each child in turn, imploring the living progeny of Kelunga to walk forward into the light. Book 5, Exodus. "And ye shall carry up my bones away hence with you." And they took their journey and encamped in the edge of the wilderness. He took not away the pillar of cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night. Exodus 13:19-22. Orleana Price, Sanderling Island, Georgia. As long as I kept moving, my grief streamed out behind me like a swimmer's long hair in water. I knew the weight was there, but it didn't touch me. Only when I stopped did the slick, dark stuff of it come floating around my face, catching my arms and throat till I began to drown. So I just didn't stop. The substance of grief is not imaginary. It's as real as rope or the absence of air, and like both those things, it can kill. My body understood there was no safe place for me to be. A mother's body remembers her babies. The folds of soft flesh, the softly furred scalp against her nose. Each child has its own entreaties to body and soul. It's the last one, though, that overtakes you. I can't dare say I loved the others less, but my first three were all babies at once, and motherhood dismayed me entirely. The twins came just as Rachel was learning to walk. What came next, I hardly remember. Whole years when I battled through every single day of grasping hands and mouths until I could fall into bed for a few short hours and dream of being eaten alive in small pieces. I counted to 100 as I rocked, contriving the patience to get one down in order to take up another. One mouth closed upon a spoon meant two crying empty, feathers flying, so I dashed back and forth like a mother bird, flouting nature's maw with a brood too large. I couldn't count on survival until all three of them could stand alone. Together they were my first issue. I took one deep breath for every step they took away from me. That's how it is with the firstborn, no matter what kind of mother you are, rich, poor, frazzled half to death, or sweetly content. A first child is your own best foot forward, and how you do cheer those little feet as they strike out. You examine every turn of flesh for precocity and crow it to the world. But the last one, the baby who trails her scent like a flag of surrender through your life when there will be no more coming after, oh, that's love by a different name. She is the babe you hold in your arms for an hour after she's gone to sleep. If you put her down in the crib, she might wake up changed and fly away. So instead you rock by the window, drinking the light from her skin, breathing her exhaled dreams. Your heart bays to the double crescent moons of closed lashes on her cheeks. She's the one you can't put down. My baby, my blood, my honest truth, entreat me not to leave thee, for whither thou goest I will go. Where I lodge, we lodge together. Where I die, you'll be buried at last. By instinct rather than will, I stayed alive. I tried to flee from the grief. It wasn't the spirit, but just a body that moved me from one place to another. I watched my hands, heard my mouth give orders, avoided corners and stillness. When I had to pause for breath, I stood in the open in the center of a room or out in the yard. The trees roared and danced as if they were on fire in the pouring rain, telling me to go on, go on. Once I'd moved our table outside, with my baby laid out upon it, I could see no sense in anything but to bring out the rest. Such a bewildering excess of things we had for one single family, and how useless it all seemed now. I carried out armloads of fabric and wood and metal put together in all their puzzling ways, and marveled that I'd ever felt comfort in having such things. I needed truth and light to remember my baby's laughter. This stuff cluttered my way. What relief to place it in the hands of women who could carry off my burden. Their industrious need made me lightheaded. My dresses would be curtains and my curtains dresses. My tea towel, a baby's diaper. Empty food tins would be pounded into palm oil lamps, toys, plowshares maybe. Who could say? My household would pass through the great digestive tract of Kilanga and turn into sights unseen. It was a miracle to witness my own simple motion amplified. As I gave it all up, the trees unrolled their tongues of flame and blazed in approval. Motion became my whole purpose. When there was nothing left to move but myself, I walked to the end of our village and kept going with a whole raft of children strung out behind me. Nothing to do but take my leave. Sala Mbote. I went on foot because I still had feet to carry me. Plain and simple, that was the source of our exodus. I had to keep moving. I didn't set out to leave my husband. Anyone can see I should have long before, but I never did know how. For women like me, it seems, it's not ours to take charge of beginnings and endings. Not the marriage proposal, the summit conquered, the first shot fired, nor the last one either, the treaty at Appomattox, the knife in the heart. Let men write those stories. I can't. I only know the middle ground where we live our lives. We whistle while Rome burns or we scrub the floor, depending. Don't dare presume there's shame in the lot of a woman who carries on. On the day a committee of men decided to murder the fledgling Congo, what do you suppose Mama Mwanza was doing? Was it different the day after? Of course not. Was she a fool then, or the backbone of a history? When a government comes crashing down, it crushes those who were living under its roof. People like Mama Mwanza never knew the house was there at all. Independence is a complex word in a foreign tongue. To resist occupation, whether you're a nation or merely a woman, you must understand the language of your enemy. Conquest and liberation and democracy and divorce are words that mean squat, basically, when you have hungry children and clothes to get out on the line, and it looks like rain. Maybe you still can't understand why I stayed so long. I've nearly finished with my side of the story, and still I feel your small round eyes looking down on me. I wonder what you'll name my sin. Complicity, loyalty, stupefaction. How can you tell the difference? Is my sin a failure of virtue or of competence? I knew Rome was burning, but I had just enough water to scrub the floor, so I did what I could. My talents are different from those of the women who cleave and part from husbands nowadays, and my virtues probably unrecognizable. But look at old women and bear in mind we are another country. We married with simple hopes, enough to eat, and children who might outlive us. My life was a business of growing where planted and making good on the debts life gathered onto me. Companionship and joy came unexpectedly, mostly in small exploding moments when I was apart from my husband and children. A kiss of flesh-colored sunrise while I hung out the wash, a sigh of indigo birds exhaled from the grass, an okapi at the water. It didn't occur to me to leave Nathan on account of unhappiness, any more than Tata Mwanza would have left his disfigured wife, though a more able woman might have grown more manioc and kept more of his children alive. Nathan was something that happened to us, as devastating in its way as the burning roof that fell on the family Mwanza. With our fates scarred by hell and brimstone, we still had to track our course. And it happened finally by the grace of hell and brimstone that I had to keep moving. I moved, and he stood still. But his kind will always lose in the end. I know this, and now I know why. Whether it's wife or nation they occupy, their mistake is the same. They stand still, and their stake moves underneath them. The Pharaoh died, says Exodus, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of their bondage. Chains rattle, rivers roll, animals startle and bolt, forests inspire and expand, babies stretch open-mouthed from the womb, new seedlings arch their necks and creep forward into the light. Even a language won't stand still. A territory is only possessed for a moment in time. They stake everything on that moment, posing for photographs while planting the flag, casting themselves in bronze. Washington crossing the Delaware, the capture of Okinawa. They're desperate to hang on. But they can't. Even before the flagpole begins to peel and splinter, the ground underneath arches and slides forward into its own new destiny. It may bear the marks of boots on its back, but those marks become the possessions of the land. What does Okinawa remember of its fall? Forbidden to make engines of war, Japan made automobiles instead and won the world. It all moves on. The great Delaware rolls on while Mr. Washington himself is no longer even what you'd call good compost. The Congo River, being of a different temperament, drowned most of its conquerors outright. In Congo, a slashed jungle quickly becomes a field of flowers, and scars become the ornaments of a particular face. Call it oppression, complicity, stupefaction, call it what you like, it doesn't matter. Africa swallowed the conqueror's music and sang a new song of her own. If you are the eyes in the trees, watching us as we walk away from Kilunga, how will you make your judgment? Lord knows after 30 years I still crave your forgiveness. But who are you? A small burial mound in the middle of Nathan's garden, where vines and flowers have long since unrolled to feed insects and children. Is that what you are? Are you still my own flesh and blood, my last born, or are you now the flesh of Africa? How can I tell the difference when the two rivers have run together so? Try to imagine what never happened. Our family without Africa, or the Africa that would have been without us. Look at your sisters now, lock, stock, and barrel. They've got their own three ways to live with our history. Some can find it. Many more never do. But which one among us is without sin? I can hardly think where to cast my stone, so I just go on keening for my own losses, trying to wear the marks of the boot on my back as gracefully as the Congo wears hers. My little beast, my eyes, my favorite stolen egg. Listen, to live is to be marked. To live is to change, to acquire the words of a story. And that is the only celebration we mortals really know. In perfect stillness, frankly, I've only found sorrow. What We Carried Out. Leah Price. Balungu, Late Rainy Season, 1961. We only took what we could carry on our backs. Mother never once turned around to look over her shoulder. I don't know what would have become of us if it hadn't been for Mama Mwanza's daughters who came running after us bringing oranges and a demijohn of water. They knew we'd get thirsty even though the rain hammered our shirts to our backs and chilled us right through the skin, and being thirsty ever again seemed out of the question. Either we'd never known such rain or we'd forgotten. In just the few hours since the storm broke, the parched road through our village had become a gushing stream of mud, blood red, throbbing like an artery. We couldn't walk in it at all and could barely keep our footing on the grassy banks beside it. A day ago we'd have given up our teeth for a good rain, and now we gnashed them in frustration over the deluge. If only we'd had a boat, it seemed possible we could ride the waves straight to Leopoldville. That's the Congo for you, famine or flood. It has been raining ever since. Late that afternoon, as we trudged along, we spotted a bright bouquet of color up ahead, glowing dimly through the rain. Eventually, I recognized the huge pink starburst across the rump of Mama Buanda. She, Mama Lo, and several others huddled together beside the road under elephant ear leaves, waiting out a particularly fierce spell of the downpour. They motioned us into their shelter, and we joined them, stupefied by the rain. It's hard to believe any water on earth could be so unequivocal. I put out my hand and watched it disappear at the end of my arm. The noise on our heads was a white roar that drew us together in our small shelter of leaves. I let my mind drift into a pleasant nowhere as I breathed the mama's peanut and manioc scent. The upright sprigs of Mama Bawanda's hair dripped from their ends like a tiny garden of leaking hoses. When it slowed back down to mere cloudburst, we set off together. The women carried leaf-wrapped packets of manioc and other things on their heads, food they were taking to their husbands in Balungu, they said. A large political meeting was going on there. Mama Lo also had palm oil to sell in Balungu. She balanced the immense rectangular can of oil on her head while she chatted with me and looked so comfortable at it that I tried placing my plastic demijohn on my own head. To my great surprise, I found I could keep it there as long as I had one hand on it. In all our time in the Congo, I'd been awestruck by what the ladies could carry this way, but had never once tried it myself. What a revelation that I could carry my own parcel like any woman here. After the first several miles, I ceased to feel the weight on my head at all. With no men around, everyone was surprisingly lighthearted. It was contagious somehow. We laughed at the unladylike ways we all sank into the mud. Ever so often, the women also sang together in little shouted bursts of call and response. Whenever I recognized the tune, I joined in. Father's mission had been a success in at least one regard. The Congolese loved our music. They could work miracles with soldiers of the cross in their own language. Even that most doleful of Christian laments, "Nobody knows the trouble I've seen," sounded snappy and upbeat through these women's windpipes as they sauntered along. Nani ose mpasi zazo, nani ose mpasi. We had seen trouble beyond compare, but in that moment as we marched along with rain streaming off the ends of our hair, it felt like we were out on a grand adventure together. Our own particular Price family sadness seemed to belong to another time that we didn't need to think about anymore. Only once I realized I was looking around for Ruth May, wondering whether she was warm enough or needed my extra shirt. Then I thought with astonishment, why, Ruth May is no longer with us. It seemed very simple. We were walking along this road, and she wasn't with us. My mind wandered around a great deal until it found Anatole. I had peculiar thoughts weighing on me that I badly needed to tell him. That the inside of a green mamba's mouth is pure sky blue, for example. And that we'd strewn ashes on the floor like Daniel, capturing the six-toed footprints, which I had not mentioned to anyone. Anatole might not be safe in Kalanga any more than we were. But perhaps nobody was safe with so many things getting turned upside down. What was the purpose of the political meeting in Balungu? Who was the secretive man Ada had seen in Axelrod's shack laughing about orders from President Eisenhower? Did they truly mean to kill Lumumba? As we passed through the forest, we heard gunfire in the distance, but none of the women spoke of it, so we didn't either. The road followed the Kwilu River upstream. I spent our year in Kilanga thinking of civilization as lying downstream from us, since that was the way the boats went to Banningville. But when Mother set out from the village on foot, she'd asked some of our neighbors which way led to Leopoldville, and they'd all agreed upstream was best. They said in 2 days we would get to Bulungu. There the path joined up with a larger road going west, overland, toward the capital. There would be trucks, the neighbor women said. Probably we could find a ride. Mother had asked the women, did they ever take the road to Leopoldville? And they looked at each other, surprised at this odd question. No, the answer was no, they'd had no reason to go that way. But they were certain we would have a pleasant trip. In fact, our shoes filled with mud, and our clothes turned to slime, and it was the farthest thing from pleasant. Mosquitoes that had lain dormant through the long drought now hatched and rose from the forest floor in clouds so thick they filled our mouths and nostrils. I learned to draw back my lips and breathe slowly through my teeth so I wouldn't choke on mosquitoes. When they'd covered our hands and faces with red welts, they flew up our sleeves and needled our armpits. We scratched ourselves raw. There were always more mosquitoes rising up from the road like great columns of smoke, always moving ahead of us, and we dreaded them. But by putting one foot ahead of the other, we traveled farther in one day than we ever had thought to go before. Sometime after dark, we arrived in the small village of Kiala. Mama Bwanda invited us to come to the house where her mother and father lived with two unmarried sisters who appeared to be 20 years older than Mama Bwanda. We couldn't really get straight whether they were actually sisters, aunts, or what, but oh, were we happy to come in out of the rain. Cows rescued from the slaughter could not have been happier. We squatted around the family's large kettle and ate fufu and nsaki greens with our fingers. Mama Bwanda's ancient parents looked just alike, both of them tiny, bald, and perfectly toothless. The Tata stared out the doorway with indifference, but the Mama paid attention and nodded earnestly while Mama Bwanda chattered on and on with a very long story. It was about us, we realized, since we heard the word Nyoka, snake, many times, and also the word Jesus. When the story ended, the old woman studied my mother for a long time while she wrapped and rewrapped her faded blue panier over her flat chest. After a time, she sighed and went out into the rain, returning shortly with a hard-boiled egg. She presented it to my mother and motioned for us to eat it. Mother peeled the egg and we divided it, crumbling it carefully from hand to mouth while the others watched us closely, as if expecting immediate results. I have no idea whether this treasured egg was meant as a special cure for sorrow, or if they merely thought we needed the protein to sustain our dreadful journey. We all shook from exhaustion. The rain and mud had made every mile into 10. Ada's weak side was overtaken by convulsive trembling, and Rachel seemed to be in a trance. The old woman worried aloud to her daughter that the guests might die in her house. This kind of thing was felt to be bad luck. But she didn't throw us out, and we were grateful. With slow, deliberate movements of her bone-thin arms, she plucked up sticks from a pile near the door and started a fire to warm us right inside the hut. The smoke made it hard to breathe, but did give us relief from the mosquitoes. We wrapped ourselves in the extra panniers offered to us as blankets and settled down on the floor to sleep among strangers. The night was pitch dark. I listened to the pounding rain on the thatch and the quiet drips that leaked through, and only then did I think of Father. They say you thatched your roof, and now you must not run out of your house if it rains. Father was no longer with us. Father and Ruth May both. As simple as that. My mind ached like a broken bone as I struggled to stand in the new place I found myself. I wouldn't see my baby sister again, this I knew. But I hadn't yet considered the loss of my father. I'd walked in his footsteps my whole life, and now, without warning, my body had fallen in line behind my mother, a woman whose flank and jaw glinted hard as salt when she knelt around a fire with other women, whose pale eyes were fixed on a distance where he couldn't follow. Father wouldn't leave his post to come after us, that much was certain. He wasn't capable of any action that might be seen as cowardice by his God, and no God in any heart on this earth was ever more on the lookout for human failing. Out of the thunderous rain, the words came to my ears in Anatole's serene, particular voice, "You must not run out of your house if it rains." Anatole translated the rage of a village into one quiet sentence that could pin a strong-willed man to the ground. It is surprising how my mother and father hardened so differently when they turned to stone. I imagined him still standing in our yard, frozen under the deluge, baptizing an endless circle of children who would slip away and return with new faces requiring his blessing. I'd never understood the size of my father's task in the world, the size or the terrible extravagance. I fell in and out of sleep under a strange dream of awful weight that I had to move to free myself, a mountain of hard-boiled eggs that turned into children when my hands touched them, dark-eyed children whose faces begged me for a handful of powdered milk, my clothes, whatever I had. "But I've brought nothing to give you," I told them, and my heart took me down like a lead weight, for no matter whether these words were true or false, they were terrible and wrong. Each time I drifted off, I sank down again through the feverish, damp scent and dark blue hopelessness of this awful dream. Finally, I shuddered it off and lay sleepless, hugging around my shoulders a thin cotton cloth that smelled of sweat and smoke. With exhaustion for company, I listened to the pounding rain. I would walk in no one's footsteps now. How could I follow my mother out of here now and run away from what we'd done? But after what we'd done, how could I stay? We didn't reach Bulungu on the second day, and on the third we came down with a fever. Our bodies finally surrendered to the overpowering assault of mosquitoes. For all these months, I'd imagined malaria as a stealthy secret enemy, but now that it was fully upon me, it was as real as anything. I could feel the poison move through my bloodstream like thick tainted honey. I pictured it as yellow in color. At first, I was terrified, shaking with the cold and the panicky flight of my heart, which seemed to be drowning as the poison rose up in my chest. But even if I could have attached words to my terror, there was no one to hear them. The rain on our heads dashed all other sound. On and on we walked, straight through fatigue and far, far beyond it. In time, I arrived at a strange, sluggish calm. I imagined honey-colored parasites celebrating in my golden-tinted organs as I alternately froze and burned. When I discovered my face was hot as a stove, I happily used it to warm my freezing hands. The rain turned to ice as it lashed my arms. The trees began to burn with a pinkish aura that soothed my eyes. I lost one of my shoes in the mud and failed to care. Then I lost the other. My legs began to fold strangely under me. At some point, I lay down in an irresistible hollow at the base of a tree and urged Mother and the others to go on without me. I have no recollection of arriving in Bulungu. I'm told I was carried on a pallet by some men who met us coming out of the jungle from a camp where they made charcoal during the dry season. I owe them my life and regret that I can't recall a face or voice or even the rhythm of their step as they carried me. I worry that I might have been indecent to them, yelling insults as Ruth May sometimes did when she was delirious with malaria fever. I suppose I'll never know. Bulungu was a whirl of excitement which I took in gradually, thinking it must be due to our arrival. That we were an unlikely cause for celebration didn't occur to me, since I was surrounded by so many other entirely improbable things. Men beating drums and dancing with the crowns of palm trees sprouting out of their heads, for example. Women with iridescent feathers on their heads and trailing down their spines. Even Axel Root's airplane with coronas of flame dancing around the wings as it touched down on a field of waving pink grass. Later on, in the dark shelter of someone's house where we were staying, I watched the man Axel Root bizarrely transformed. The Underwood Devil's horns glowed through his slick down hair as he sat in front of the window facing my mother. A living tail crept like a secretive velvet snake through the rungs of the chair behind him. I couldn't take my eyes off that sinister restlessness. He held the tail in his left hand, trying to quiet it down as he talked, discussing Rachel. Mother's profile in the window turned to salt crystal, reflecting all light. Other people came and went through the darkness where I lay under thatch, sheltered in my cave of dreams and rain. Sometimes I recognized Grandfather Wharton by my bed, patiently waiting for me to take my turn. With a guilty shock, I saw we were playing checkers, and I wasn't holding up my end. Grandfather told me in the most offhand manner that we'd both died. My father came only once, with blue flames curling from his eyebrows and tongue. "Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all." The thin blue line of words rose straight up from his lips through the air. I watched, entranced. At the point where they touched the thatched ceiling, they became a line of ants. Morning and dusk and morning again, I watched them trailing up to a hole in the peak of the roof, carrying their tiny burdens out into the light. Nothing here has surprised me, least of all the presence of Anatole Ngumba. One morning he was here, and every day after that, holding a burning tin cup of bitter tea to my mouth and repeating my name, Beene, Beene. the truest truth.